This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany last week brought together leaders from 20 of the world's top economies. It was a very interesting meeting. You had lots of intrigue, like the first face-to-face meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. You had Angela Merkel lamenting the fact that the United States had withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement. You had the streets of Hamburg filled with violent protesters, cars being torched, police being assaulted. I've invited trumpet writers Richard Palmer and Andrew Miller to have an extended conversation about some of the takeaways from the G20 summit. That's going to take up the first half of today's program. Then we're going to switch gears and look at the situation developing in the Middle Eastern nation of Qatar. Tension is rising between this nation and several others in the region, led by Saudi Arabia and Egypt. The United States is trying to smooth things over, but it looks like the future of the Gulf Cooperation Council is in jeopardy, and when it's all said and done, this could actually end up strengthening Iran. We're going to talk about this with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal in Jerusalem. I'll finish the program today by giving you some secret clues about your interactions with your spouse that can tell you whether your marriage is going to last. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Last Friday and Saturday, the G20 summit met in Hamburg, Germany. Leaders from the 20 of the world's leading economies gathered together to discuss a range of issues. And with as many major issues facing the world as we have today, this meeting really was very interesting. It seemed like it was fraught with quite a lot of intrigue, more than usual. We just want to talk about some of the points that we took away from what happened there. And I have two of our trumpet writers and regular week in review contributors, Andrew Miller here in the studio in Edmond, and from Britain, Richard Palmer. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
So this was U.S. President Donald Trump's first major international conference. It seems like these other nations, in some ways, they were kind of coming to terms with just what it means to have Donald Trump there at the table with them. Last week, we talked about some of most dramatically, the trade deal that was made between Japan and the European Union beforehand, and really the timing of that taking place right before the G20 summit. It definitely seemed like it was intentionally aimed at sending a message about how the world is going to be able to do just fine, even if Donald Trump is making these very strong protectionist moves that are aimed at disrupting world trade. Your thoughts on that aspect of it, Richard?
Yeah, I think it went a lot more smoothly than his trip to NATO, I think, and Europe got a lot more of what they wanted out of this. He did agree to sign up to the anti-protectionist declaration that they produced at the end of that conference, whereas U.S. representatives had refused to sign up to that kind of deal before. When he was in Poland ahead of time, he pledged to defend Europe and to support that Article 5 commitment, where he had refused to do that before. So
yeah, there were some people who, listening to the speech that he gave in Poland, they basically said, well, that was a marvelous speech. It just contradicted everything that he said before he got to Poland.
Yeah, I think Charles Krauthammer had made that point quite eloquently, where he's like, that speech in Poland was awesome. He said it was just kind of weird that it's like the exact opposite of his inauguration speech back in January.
Right. But yeah, it's almost like he's become he's come around to see some of the need for some of the internationalism that he had rejected earlier.
Yes, though I think everyone in Europe is, given these contradictions, they're probably thinking, well, this is all very well, but will you still believe that next week?
Right.
Which is why you had things like the that Japan trade deal, which, obviously they didn't know exactly how Mr. Trump was going to react at this meeting. So they had that lined up ahead of time. And, everything about this meeting in a lot of ways was arranged to emphasize free trade, open trade. This was deliberately in Hamburg, Germany's biggest port on the River Elbe there, the second busiest port in all of Europe. And I believe the location was chosen before Donald Trump was elected. But still, going into this conference from quite a long way out, Germany has been planning to accentuate its free trade and its kind of trade leader credentials. So, yep, Donald Trump did go along with that to a certain extent this time, more than it looked like he might have done in the past. But you're still seeing Europe trying to position itself as an alternative economic leader. And you know, at a G20 summit, the meeting of the world's 20 largest economies, that's a key place to do that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this this Japan-EU trade deal, because that definitely was aimed at positioning themselves to succeed in a Trumpian trade universe. If he's pulling the United States back or he's throwing up protectionist measures, they're saying, well, we're going to make sure that it's wide open in two of these massive markets. And because they did it, because it was timed the way that it was, it seemed it was aimed even more at sending that message, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it was. I think saying that they've done a trade deal might be taking thing. It'd probably be more accurate to say they hope to do a trade deal. What they gave ahead of the meeting was broad outlines. They're probably at least 1 year, probably more away from actually getting all the specifics sorted. But it was still, it was a statement of intent, and it's a statement of intent to form a trade bloc that would be of a similar size to NAFTA, which is currently the world's largest trading bloc. And so it's a bid from these two to become that trading power. And then once you're the world's largest trade bloc, you can start setting rules for the whole world, and kind of like a global version of the California effect, where California is such a large market that everybody across the United States conforms to the laws in California, which is why you constantly buy products in the United States that say, well, this is known to the state of California to cause cancer. You know, you have to conform to the rules of the most populous state. And it would be the same with the EU and Japan. So they're really putting forward a bid to be the global rulemaker and dominant economy that way.
For Japan to orient itself toward Europe so forcefully, and as you said, this was a statement of intent. It wasn't a trade deal. But in some ways, I think that almost underlines the point, the fact that they were so hasty to put this together in a way where they were able to make this splashy announcement before the G20 the way that they did. But considering just how strong the alliance has been between the United States and Japan historically, this really demonstrates a change in orientation.
It does. And remember, they were working on a trade deal with the United States before this. And Europe had been kind of knocking on Japan's door, trying to get Japan interested in a trade deal. And Japan just wasn't really interested. It was a low priority because they were working on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And once Donald Trump pulled America out of that, that's when Japan really started to get keen on finding a replacement. Remember, Japan has a lot of long-term economic problems, and so boosting their trade, that's something they're very keen on, and if they can't do that through TTIP and through increased trade with the United States, well, they were pretty keen on finding another partner as soon as they possibly could.
So here you have this happening on the trade front. You also had a pretty strong consensus outside of the United States. There was a lot of discussion about the Paris Climate Agreement. They brought up the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, which is basically an outreach of the same goals that they were pursuing in Paris. The United States is the one nation that abstains from this. So you have the G19 that are all on board with this, where Donald Trump is notably absent, and several statements from Angela Merkel and other leaders basically saying, you know, we regret the fact that the United States is taking this position, but we're not going to allow them to slow us down or prevent us from moving forward with these initiatives.
Yeah, it's a big, it's a big alienation of between the president and Europe. I mean, this has long been a bone of contention between Europe and the United States, even going back to the Kyoto Accords. And I mean, really, it's just Donald Trump refusing to play this game and refusing to talk in terms that the European public like. I mean, in terms of actual results,
right?
The United States doesn't sign up to these international agreements and doesn't really talk about it, and has actually been quite successful in achieving the aims of these agreements, in things like bringing down CO2 levels and that kind of thing. While at the same time, Germany talks an excellent game and sounds great and wins the applause of public opinion around the world, while having a very terrible track record at doing exactly that. So it's all hypocrisy. It's all, you know, appealing to voters. People have said that this green consciousness is the closest thing Germany has to a national religion at the moment. So it's something that makes America very, very unpopular without really making a huge lot of difference when it comes to actual results.
Right. That has always been interesting to me, as you get a nation like China, who they're lauding them as being a great team player on the Paris Accords, even though they have pretty much said they're not going to be even starting to cut emissions for like another 10 years now. Or a nation like Germany, which is the world's leader in renewable energy, but the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So you have to have backups for the time when the energy is low, and most of that's done with coal. So by the time you've gotten all this coal backing up your renewable sources, their carbon emissions aren't great either. So it really is kind of America that's get all these great new technologies to make these fossil fuel plants more environmentally friendly than they have been, and yet they are still slurred as the worst bad guy on the world scene because they're not part of this agreement.
But it is important to note how deep-seated this – I mean, I remember basically being taught going through high school about how America was this big bad guy, and you know, the whole world had kind of come together and agreed on the Kyoto principles, and this was going to stop global warming. But the evil United States was getting in the way and was stopping this from being a success. And that's not too much of an exaggeration to how things like this are portrayed in high school. And it's a major factor in Germany having this predominantly negative opinion, as they do now, of the United States. I think I saw one poll saying it was something like 54% negative. It's something that is really deeply, you know, it's something that's really used to turn a lot of the world against America.
Right. And in the short term, it probably doesn't have much effect in the next little bit. But in the long term, I was just kind of surprised that after President Trump pulled us out of the Paris agreements, apparently one of the members of the European Union Parliament had to come out and issue a clarification that the European Union was not going to levy sanctions against the United States for doing this. And of course, right now, the main reason they're not levying sanctions against the United States for doing this is they're now nowhere in an economic position to do so. But the fact that they even had to bring that up shows that there are definitely very many influential people in many nations across the world that if their things changed or they were in an economic position to do so, would love to use like some of these trade deals they're negotiating with Japan and other places to put some sort of retaliatory tariffs or trade embargoes or sanctions against the United States.
Well, I think it's interesting to just talk about the difference between the reality in an accord like that and the appearance and the PR side of things. And it seems like what we probably the main thing that came out of this in a lot of ways was what was happening in the city around where these discussions were taking place. Hamburg really was riven with rioters and protesters and a whole lot of people who were very upset about what was going on there. And it seems like this negative image that Donald Trump has projected, that a lot of people really see him as the embodiment of all evil, that kind of came to a head with the protests. There tends to be a fair amount of protesting around these meetings wherever they take place, but this really was kind of hitting a new high in just the amount of antipathy there was for what was going on here. There's really an interesting confluence of forces here between the anti-globalists, anti-capitalists, anti-Trumpers, the environmentalists, people who were really opposed to a lot of what was going on there. You actually are working on an article on this aspect of it specifically. Can you just share some of your takeaways from the protests, Richard?
Yeah, these protests were very significant. I think that the German press has been talking about them as an orgy of violence. They've been rioters, just looting stores. I saw pictures of a supermarket that had just been absolutely trashed, burning cars, attacking police with rocks, with fireworks. There are some quite dramatic videos out there of some of these clashes, or of just somebody just driving around Hamburg, just seeing all of these cars on fire. The property damage is going to easily run into the millions on this. One police spokesman's called it a new dimension of violence. Germany's justice minister said that Germany has reached a historic high point in terms of politically motivated violence. So it was a very significant outbreak of mass rioting and attack. I think it was about 500 police were injured and had to be hospitalized with what was going on there. And you had 20,000 police in the city. So it was a significant number of police there, but they still struggled just to keep these demonstrations under control.
What all do you, in your view, is contributing this? What are some of the reasons why we saw such a violent uprising within Germany?
I think there's two main strands here. One is that you're having a very dangerous increase in left-wing extremism in Germany anyway. A few people are making this point. I think it's an excellent one. I think Douglas Murray, who was one of the ones made it the best in his blog for The Spectator. But he talks about just how much attention would this have been getting if these were far-right protesters, mm-hmm. if they transformed Germany's second biggest city into a war zone like this. It would be all over the news. And so, and just because these protesters are labeled far left instead of far right, it gets much less attention. But it is a really big deal that there is this much violent dissatisfaction within Germany. And, we can't, it's some are kind of saying, well, okay, it was just 1,500, I think, is the police estimate of the number that were violent, while you had kind of more than 100,000 that perhaps didn't participate mm-hmm. directly in this looting. But the first official march of this weekend of protests was titled Welcome to Hell. So, I mean, that's hardly an invitation to an exercise of your right to peaceful protest right there. So even some of these 100,000 or so that weren't directly involved maybe in setting fire to cars, they were right behind them in that anger. And this is something that's been building in Germany for some time. The German Interior Minister, they recently wrote that in the past few years, the acceptance and intensity of violence in the far left scene has noticeably increased. There are Europol charted how far left violence all across Europe went through a dramatic jump from 2015 to 2016. You look at Germany's Die Linke, or the left party within Germany, and that's the successor party to the Communist Party that ruled East Germany. That is, it's kind of a contender up there with Mao Zedong's China is one of the most murderous regimes in all time. They're growing in popularity. They're even now leading a state government, or as part of a coalition of a state government, which they've never been before, after a series of what were outstanding election results for them. So you're seeing a big uptick over the last few years in extreme left-wing thought, action, support within Germany. And so that's one major danger there. You've got this really growing movement that say they want to smash the system. Mm-hmm. And fine, they're left-wing, but the Nazi stands for National Socialist. The Nazi party could perhaps be called radical left every bit as much as they could have been called far right.
Right.
Or as they are called far right. So there's that trend within Germany that is extremely dangerous. But then you also have this kind of international movement then that was getting behind what was going on in Germany, and getting and joining up with this German far left movement. So you had the New York mayor, Bill de Blasio, controversially, he came out there and addressing the he was addressing the crowds on Saturday. And again, this was after the kind of the Welcome to Hell march. It was after a lot of these violent protests had already gotten started. It was after, for example, I believe somebody narrowly avoided someone shot like a flare gun at a helicopter and only narrowly missed it.
So he knew what he was getting into.
Exactly. Yeah. You could see what these protests were like. And he was over there and he was, off supporting, rallying, encouraging these protesters. And then even Pope Francis has been writing about his, he's been writing about, he said, the G20 worries me. And he's talked about how he fears very dangerous alliances emerging from this meeting. So that even the Pope has kind of been lending his moral support to this far left movement. So you see this growing far left scene in Germany that comes from dissatisfaction within Germany and Europe merging with this global far left dissatisfaction with the just the global political and economic order.
I think there's just a whole lot here that we need to be concerned about when you see this merging of these revolutionary forces. You were talking about what was happening in Germany, but you see this happening in Britain. You see it happening in the United States. It's happening in other European countries where there's this determination to they're identifying that there's problems that they don't like with the system as it is, and they want to basically just knock it down and start over. And the momentum that is building, when you're talking about, Bill de Blasio, which he's a pretty extreme politician in the United States. I think there are a lot of people that don't give him any credence whatsoever. But you see what's happening in the Democratic Party within the United States and the leaders that are kind of coming to the fore that are far more radical than what we have seen to this point. You see Bernie Sanders making comments that are very inciting of revolutionary spirit among Democratic supporters. You see the success that Jeremy Corbyn had in the UK, and here you have, like you mentioned, the Pope himself coming out. He's the titular head of a billion supporters worldwide. These are not fringe leaders who are coming out and saying this. I mean, maybe a couple of months ago we thought of Jeremy Corbyn as a fringe candidate, but it turns out he's not. He has a lot more support than what we expected.
Right. That is just so surprising, is that especially here in the United States, you almost assume like the Social Democratic Party in Germany is further left than we are. And yet that party has come out and condemned some of these violent protests in Hamburg. Now, like Richard said, the former communist Die Linke, they've been more supportive. But the Social Democratic Party has just come out and condemned that, which is something that we don't even see in America or Britain anymore, like the Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party or the U.S. Democratic Party. You don't see them condemning the riots at Berkeley or the riots on university campuses like that anymore. So in some ways, just as far as this kind of like this violent anti-capitalist spirit, you're getting some of these parties that used to be that are mainstream endorsing more radical techniques than even the Social Democratic parties of Europe, which were considered the more radical just 10 years ago.
It seems like unless someone steps up and puts this down, that it's just continuing to grow and it's fomenting and building a certain amount of momentum. And where do you see the will to actually say, no, what you're doing is unlawful? You're not going to be permitted to continue this. In fact, you see in a lot of cases leaders actually encouraging it rather than recognizing that it needs to be stopped.
Yeah, I think that's the real, when you say where do you see the will to stop this, I think the really interesting thing is the only place I see it really is Germany. I think it's kind of interesting to look at, like Andrew said, top leaders from the Social Democrats are all criticizing this in very strong terms. And then you go over to the right-wing parties in Germany, and Germany's interior minister basically said that these left-wing protesters are every bit as bad as neo-Nazis and Islamic Islamist terrorists. So, there's a lot of support for the far left in Germany. We've just talked about that. But from those that aren't in the far left, I think there's a real sense of outrage now in Germany that something must be done. There's a lot of anger directed at both the Social Democratic mayor of Hamburg and the conservative Angela Merkel that for just even allowing this to get out of control like this.
That's really
They're not at all happy that was able to happen. And so, you know, Germany is talking about things like a pan-European watch list of far-left extremists, controls on where they can travel, doing much more at home to break up far-left extremist groups, even shutting down what maybe loosely you could consider Germany's equivalent of things of movements, say like Black Lives Matter, that kind of give some support to some of these groups, to even just get rid of. They're talking in Hamburg about kind of getting rid of some of, say, the community centers that left-wing activists meet in, this kind of thing. So it's still early days. We're 2-3 days out from the protests, but it looks like there could be some real action and perhaps some really strong action within Germany to directly confront this.
That's very interesting. Definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on. Just talking about the Pope, and so he's coming out and he's saying, well, you know, what the G20 stands for, we really need to, there's some real areas of concern here. And of course, he's positioned himself much more on the socialist side of the economic spectrum and come out with very strong statements against capitalism and America's role within the capitalist economy globally. But he also made some interesting statements that you could look at as being somewhat contradictory to that, or at least he's not going full out with the left-wing protesters in the streets. Maybe you can fill us in on what else he's been saying, Andrew.
Right. Well, that's on a big thing with Pope Francis is and the Catholic Church in general, is he's not necessarily trying to agitate class warfare, but he's trying to get the leaders of Europe to address, take a more socialist approach to the demands that these protesters want. He keeps saying that like the key to stopping populist revolt or unrest is that the leaders they need to like see is like, okay, well, what are these people demanding? And I mean, they want money and they want some of the more of these social welfare programs and government guarantees of good jobs and all that. And he's like, okay, well, then you need to start providing them with that. He's definitely positioning the state as the solution. And I guess the big story this week is he'd given an interview with Eugene Scalfari, who's a noted atheist journalist in Italy, who's pretty close friends with the Pope. And so the day before the G20 summit, he called him and said, he's like, well, I'm just really worried about this summit. I'd like to give an interview. And then the interview wasn't published till after the summit. But he was saying, he's like, I'm just really concerned that there's this these dangerous alliances at the G20 between nations that have a distorted worldview. It's like nations like America and Russia and China and North Korea and Syria. And he's like, says, and they're making these agreements that are they're against the poor and they're against the excluded and they're against the immigrants. And we just need a really an advocate for these immigrants and impoverished peoples around the world. And then Scalfari actually jumped in the interview. He's like, yeah, he's like, I really think that the only way we're going to get some of these things accomplished and solving things like this migrant crisis is that Europe needs to stop trying to solve things on a national level and adopt like a federal structure. And then the Pope definitely agreed with that. He's like, yes, he's like, Europe needs to adopt a federal structure as soon as possible. Otherwise, it's just not going to count for anything in the world. So that's his solution, is like, says he's trying to, I mean, he's taken the side of the socialist and the leftist and
those
and the
who
third
are trying
world.
To tear down the internationalist structure of the G20. And in one sense, he's against that internationalism. On another, on a federal level, in the European Union, or the European project, he wants to see more integration.
Right. I think he's very much for the globalist, internationalist approach to things, but he's wanting the leaders of this globalist, internationalist approach to take a more more socialist approach to the lower classes and the developing world.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Richard?
Yeah, I think I think the whole situation with the Catholic Church is just very interesting to watch right now. I mean, we know where this is going. We've been talking for a long time about how the European Union is ultimately going to be, you know, this much more closely knit nation, and that's going to be led by Germany and the Catholic Church. And it is kind of interesting now that you have, in some aspects, the two of them pushing in opposite directions, with the Pope supporting some of these protesters and Germany being one of the most foremost leaders against them. So, I don't know, we know where this is headed, and you can certainly see, like Andrew was saying, aspects of how the Pope's position is really going to lead to that. And actually, you know, in terms of a federal Europe and being the ones to solve the problem, that's pretty similar to the position of Germany's Social Democrats at the moment. So you can definitely see how this can move forward. But at the same time, you could see the path not being completely smooth or straightforward with some of, how some of this goes. And at the same time, you've got a lot of turmoil within the Catholic Church. We just saw Cardinal Müller forced out last week. Some of these kind of right-wing figures within the church that at the Trumpet we've had our eyes on for a long time. I think Müller was personally chosen by Pope Benedict to succeed him in that kind of crucial department there in the doctrines of the faith. So it's going to be it's going to be interesting just to see exactly how we get from A to B.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors at play right now, and it seems like the G20 summit in some ways it exposed the current state of where a lot of these things are, and just seeing all of these factors converge really is fascinating to witness. So Richard has an article up on thetrumpet.com if you want to check it out. EU and Japan outline new free trade deal. Both of these gentlemen are working on articles that should be up there within the next day or two. Richard, you're writing on the protests, is that right?
That's right. Working title, The Far Left versus Germany.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, you're talking about the Pope.
Yeah, I've got the Pope. Yeah, Pope Calls for Federal Europe is working title, which hopefully will be done by the end of the day.
Well, we've been talking with Trumpet writers Richard Palmer and Andrew Miller about the G20 summit and the ramifications in several different areas of what's happening in the world today. We just stay tuned for these articles on thetrumpet.com. And gentlemen, I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
There's an interesting power struggle taking place in the Middle East right now. Saudi Arabia is leading an effort to pry the nation of Qatar away from Iran. It's a very tangible point of friction in the larger struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran for dominance in the region. Recently, a Saudi-led alliance of Arab states sent Qatar a list of demands, and Qatar ignored them. Analysts say that these demands actually were unreasonable, that Qatar couldn't have met them, but it appears that this effort to isolate Iran could actually end up strengthening Iran. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So talk to us, first of all, about these demands. You had Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Egypt. They're putting pressure on Qatar. What are they asking for specifically? What are they trying to accomplish here?
Well, there are a number of demands. I think there was 12 or 13 in all. And very serious demands, to the point that people were saying this is almost impossible for Qatar to yield to these. It basically would declare themselves a vassal state of the Saudis, basically, if they agree to all of these, three of which were to reduce their diplomatic representation with Iran, shut down all attachés, expel IRGC elements from Qatar as well. They had grown closer. The relationship between Iran and Qatar has grown closer over the past probably half decade. This is an ongoing problem. And basically, they share the largest natural gas field in the world there in the Persian Gulf, the Iranians and the Qataris. So there is a natural economic union there, but it seemed to be quite growing closer, especially after the election of Rouhani. The Qatari leader called him and congratulated him over the phone, which the Saudis didn't take too much. So anyway, they're trying to reduce that relationship with Iran, number one. Also, they asked Qatar to they said that they must sever their ties with terrorist organizations such as the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic State, Hezbollah, Hamas as well. And this is a very big point because Qatar has, in the absence of Iran funding Hamas, at least the Palestinian group based out of Gaza, Qatar has filled that void over the past half decade as well. So they said, you've got to stop that. And then one of the other big ones was that they were announcing, well, they asked them to shut down Al Jazeera. That is the massive media giant and its all affiliated channels throughout the Middle East, not just out of Qatar. This was used and has been used in the past as a mouthpiece for anti-Saudi Arabian propaganda. It could be said that not just anti-Western, anti-US, but also anti-Saudi Arabian and anti-Emirati as well, anti-Egyptian, the current leader of Egypt. So they wanted all those things. Those are the biggest three that they wanted them to change.
So fulfill these demands or what?
Or what? That's a good question. And those 10 days elapsed on July 5th and nothing has really happened just yet. Because what can really happen, they're trying to squeeze the Qataris over to their side. And Qatar, again, is the richest nation in the world by GDP per capita. They have massive amounts of gas. They did say no more trade between our countries. All the food stopped going into Qatar. But then, you know, the Turks and the Iranians said, hey, we will supply you with food. And so Qatar's got a small population, so it's pretty easy to fly through a few jetliners over with food and fill the supermarket shelves. Apparently the supermarkets right now are stocked with Turkish and Iranian goods. So the question is, and then there was obviously all the flights that were going to go to those other Middle Eastern states stopped, but then the Iranians opened up their airspace to Qatari flights. So how much, if you've got a really rich country that can survive quite a lot under economic siege, and it has many other friends in the region, then how successful are you going to be? That's the big question.
Well, yeah, I'm having a hard time understanding just how this isn't some kind of miscalculation on the part of Saudi Arabia and these other nations. I mean, when you've got Saudi Arabia and Egypt behind an initiative like this, you'd think, well, this is a serious attempt at curbing Qatar, but how does Qatar respond other than just, given the severity of the demands and really not a whole lot of incentive, what is the incentive for Qatar to respond to this? What's at stake if they don't comply?
Right. Well, most people that are familiar with the situation realize that this has gone on for hundreds of years between the two royal families here in these countries. And
Saudi Arabia and Qatar, you're talking about.
Yeah, yes. And if you look back into, I believe it's 1996, you did have a situation where the Saudis sent in 600 troops to try and force some regime change. And that might be where this is going. That is really, I think, what is being held over the heads of the Qataris right now. Will there be an attempted coup by the Saudis, the Emiratis? Their military force is so much more powerful than theirs. And it's kind of what I'm reading is that you know, this is the ultimatum that they're giving them. They haven't said as much, but you better give in to our demands or potentially we might have some type of military takeover. I know that sounds kind of crazy in our day and age, but it has. There were attempts to do that in the 90s here in Qatar. I don't know if that is going to happen tomorrow, and I don't think it will, but that's certainly on the table. The other big player in this is the United States. The United States does not want this to get out of hand. The United States is kind of playing both sides right here, just because with the Saudis, you know, this was the first stop again on President Trump's foreign visit to the Middle East. And he was there talking very strong against Iran. And then immediately after his soon thereafter, after he left Saudi Arabia, it was the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Emiratis coming out with these demands on with this blockade against Qatar. So they were kind of mobilized by the change in the American administration, thinking that they had a friend. And indeed they did, because Trump wanted to kind of curb what Iran was doing. But at the same time, you have Qatar being the largest American military base, holding the largest military base in the Middle East. And so the U.S. does not want this to blow up. It needs that base in Qatar, but it also wants to curb Iran's growth across the Middle East.
Right. Well, the list of demands that you were talking about, cutting off diplomatic ties with Iran, cutting off support for terrorism. I don't know about what they think about Al Jazeera, but you would think that the United States would be pretty strongly behind those demands. But I wonder if here you've got Rex Tillerson, U.S. Secretary of State, going into Qatar on Tuesday, trying to smooth things over and come to some kind of an agreement here. You just wonder if maybe the United States is thinking, well, they're using a pretty blunt instrument here, and there's a better way of managing this. But everything coming out of the Trump administration seems to be pretty consistently anti-Iran. So, you know, it is interesting to see the United States trying to play a bit of a mediating position here.
Right. It's very difficult for them. I almost pity Mr. Tillerson, his job, to try and mediate this, just because Mr. Trump, again, he was very much for this blockade. He tweeted about the Qataris going to force them to stop supporting terrorism and such. It might be that these demands are just trying to just the first negotiating position by the Saudis to try and know that all these won't be met. They might actually accept Al Jazeera staying open, but at least some of the ties to Iran and the stopping of the support of radical elements inside Egypt, inside Libya, in Hamas, those things they are really dead serious about.
So Qatar is a part of the Gulf Cooperation Council, along with five other Persian Gulf states.
For now they are, yes.
Well, that's kind of the issue here, is does Qatar remain a part of that, or are we witnessing essentially a fracturing of the GCC that could end up maybe throwing the balance of power more Iran's direction?
Right. That's a question, because we have even one of the other GCC members, Oman, they haven't jumped on board with this either. So you've got I think only three of the GCC members, Kuwait hasn't, because they wanted to play the mediator role. So you've got the GCC that is in danger of fracturing as well, completely splitting. And it's hard to see how Iran won't leverage this situation and try and say to Qatar, hey, come over here. We will help you. We will provide all your needs. And they certainly can provide a lot of their needs. The big thing coming up here is the 2020, is it the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, or the Olympics? One of the two. It's being hosted in Qatar, and there's $200 billion worth of construction to take place. And Qatar is going to have to find the wherewithal, not necessarily the cost, but the labor of the engineers to actually implement this. And Iran, it seems, is already lining up to supply a lot of the manpower that is lacking. So there are economic benefits that are going to come to Iran. Qatar doesn't want to be in Iran's camp. It doesn't want to be in the Saudi Arabian camp. It wants to maintain an independent foreign policy. And that's why it's played off the two for so long, to the point that Saudi Arabia has done this. But it does threaten to push Qatar over to Iran. And Iran wouldn't like anything more than for the GCC to break up.
Right. Yeah, well, it is interesting just because we talk so much about the two main prophecies that describe, say, the alliances that are really going to define the Middle East in the time ahead. The Psalm 83 alliance with Saudi Arabia featuring prominently, the King of the South with Iran being at the head of that. Given the King of the South prophecy, we do have a pretty good idea of who the main players in that Iran-led alliance are going to be. Where does Qatar fit into this?
It's an interesting question. It is an Arab state, and it's on the Saudi Peninsula, so we would think that it would fit into the Psalm 83 alliance or the counter-Iranian alliance. But I think just taking a step back and looking at this from the sense of who makes up this King of the South alliance, it's interesting because we look at the Middle East and tend to talk about Shia and Sunni, the two divisions of Islam, and generally we have those sects warring against one another. But the King of the South in the Bible, the nations that make up that, it is led by a Shiite power, but there are plenty of Sunni states involved mm-hmm. with it, in a relationship with it. So it's good to look at the region in terms of nations that are trying to advance its foreign interests through the support of Islamists and the Islamic idea. And that's Iran heading that. You also have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt that wants that. You have different groups in Libya that want that. You even have Qatar that wants that as well. And if you look at some of these demands if you look back into where Qatar has supported, they've supported Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood back in 2012 and 13. They supported the Islamist groups in Libya. Those nations are actually prophesied to fall with Iran, and they're Sunni. And Qatar, it seems, might be a glimpse into this bridge between Sunni states and Shiite states that makes up the King of the South alliance. People talk about our King of the South alliance and say, it'll never happen. It can't happen. It doesn't follow the sectarian alliance of the Middle East. Well, the Bible says it's going to happen. And this relationship with Qatar, Iran, and these other Sunni states proves that it really can happen.
We'll have to keep our eye on it. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about what's happening in Qatar and the tension that is existing and ramping up between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Iran kind of presenting itself as the savior, if we can use that word, for Qatar. But Brent is working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. And it seems like it's definitely an ongoing, developing situation that's really in flux right now, and particularly with the United States being in the mix and trying to at least tamp down the severity of the tension there. We'll have to see how this unfolds, but we appreciate you at least bringing us up to speed on where we are to this point, and we'll watch for your report. Thanks a lot, Brent.
No problem.
It's time for today's last word.
Will your marriage last? Social scientists can have a pretty good idea just by listening to you and your spouse converse on just about anything for only a few minutes. When you talk to your mate, you probably don't realize how much you communicate beyond the content of your words. That smile, that tone of voice, that roll of the eyes. You are constantly, automatically broadcasting signals about your underlying attitudes regarding him or her. Beginning in the 1980s, John Gottman ran a lab at the University of Washington where he monitored thousands of married couples having conversations. In addition to videotaping them, He hooked up each spouse to electrodes and sensors that measured heart rate, skin temperature, and other physical particulars during the conversation. His staff interpreted all these nuances in order to register a specific emotion out of a list of 20, neutral, admiration, anger, sadness, whining, and so on each spouse for each second of interaction. That sequence of emotions, meticulously analyzed, provides remarkably accurate information about the health and the long-term prognosis for that marriage. In fact, if Gottman analyzed an hour of discussion between a husband and a wife, he could predict with 95% accuracy whether they would still be married 15 years later. How is that possible? Well, essentially, his staff measured the amount of positive and negative emotion in a couple's interaction. Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this in his book, Blink. He wrote, "One of Gottman's findings is that for a marriage to survive, the ratio of positive to negative emotion in a given encounter has to be at least 5 to 1. 5 to 1. A healthy marriage needs at least 5 times more positive feelings than negative." Now, this is interesting. When you look at it from a biblical perspective, God knows marriage. He created it. He knows how it has to work, and he really keeps it simple for us in giving us instruction about it. In a single Bible verse, God spells out exactly the basis for a healthy marital relationship. Ephesians 5 and verse 33, it says, "A husband must love his wife, and a wife must reverence her husband," or respect her husband. Love covers a multitude of sins. It glides past the minor irritations of daily living. 1 Corinthians 13 says, "Godly love is patient, it's kind, it's never irritable or resentful, always eager to believe the best." So a husband who loves his wife never lets petty flaws overwhelm his underlying glow for her and his sense of appreciation for the value and the richness that she adds to his life. Reverence or respect is rooted in a deep respect for a husband's office as the head of the family. A wife who reverences her husband never lets his imperfections overwhelm her abiding honor for him and her loving respect and her appreciation for his leadership. When love and reverence form the core of a husband and wife relationship, there's a virtuous cycle of positive emotion that binds the two closer as time goes on. When there's an erosion of those basic requirements, when a husband and wife routinely violate that biblical command, then the relationship spirals into negative territory. And the longer that goes on, the deeper the damage to both husband and wife, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. Malcolm Gladwell quotes Gottman saying, "People are in one of two states in a relationship. The first is what I call positive sentiment override, where positive emotion overrides irritability. It's like a buffer. Their spouse will do something bad and they'll say, oh, he's just in a crummy mood." That is a believe the best approach. You give the other person the benefit of the doubt because you have a prevailing love or reverence for that person. Gottman went on, he said, or they can be in a negative sentiment override so that even a relatively neutral thing that a partner says can get perceived as negative. How often does this happen in your marriage? Whenever I catch that starting to crop up between my wife and me, I know we're overdue for a date. We need some one-on-one time together where we can really catch up on each other's lives. But when negative sentiment override prevails, one spouse feels not just like the other person said or did something wrong, but that there's something wrong with the person. He or she gets irritated not with what they did, but with who they are. Gottman suggests that our daily interactions are like a stock market chart with ups and downs every day, and then also a larger, more gradually sloping trajectory. And he says some go up, some go down, but once they start going down toward negative emotion, 94% will continue going down. He highlights what he calls the worst relationship killers, the emotions that he calls the four horsemen: defensiveness, stonewalling or turning away, more prevalent in men; criticism, condemning a person's character, which is more prevalent in women; and contempt, which is actually trying to put the other person on a lower plane than yourself. You can really see how the four horsemen, what he calls the four horsemen, these are the opposite of what we might call the two pillars, the love and the reverence that God commands. Give your spouse the benefit of the doubt. In your daily interactions, check to make sure that you're in positive sentiment override. You allow those minor irritations to just brush past. Let love and reverence form the basis of your attitudes toward each other. When you do so, you virtually guarantee that the overall arc of your relationship will rise toward a greater, more godly love for one another. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on today's program, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Euripides: man's best possession is a sympathetic wife. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.